now. Go ahead. Thank you for accepting the invitation, by the way.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. So I wanted to do something different this time. You know, usually talk about finance and economics, but there's something more fundamental going on in Lebanon, which I think we all need to think about, which is the answer to the question, why does nothing ever get done here? Why is it so hard for decisions to be made? Why are we living through this self-inflicted wound? And I, you know, we need answers that are more convincing or more analytically convincing than just, you know, they're a bunch of crooks and they don't want to do anything. There has to be some kind of a analytical framework that we can use to understand, you know, why is that the case here? Because in any other country, you know, at least the minimum number of decisions would have been made to at least try to start getting us out of this crisis. And in thinking about that a lot, especially after the French initiative and its failure, I started seeing a lot in kind of the interaction between different political groups in Lebanon that reminded me of my old international relations graduate school days. In the way these factions interact with each other, in the way decisions are made, in the way, you know, the way these factions have these considerations for what decisions they made in terms of their cooperation, conflict between one another, concessions. So I realized that a lot of people, and, you know, a lot of this stuff is intuitive to Lebanese people. They just know that this is how the system works. But putting it into a theoretical framework, I think, was helpful for me, at least, in understanding why all this effort that a lot of us have put in the last year has been kind of useless. And so people who have studied international relations, a lot of this will be familiar to them. But for those who haven't, I think some of it might be interesting. So in international relations, well, what is it, firstly? It's basically, it's a field of study around how states interact with one another, how they cooperate, how they go into conflict in a very particular kind of system, which is described as anarchy. So anarchy doesn't mean chaos. All it means is that there is no, you know, higher authority, a supreme sovereign that can use coercion or, you know, against the players or the states or enforce laws or order. It's just independent states that have to interact with one another. There's nothing above them that can enforce anything on them. And it's basically, it's widely accepted as the fundamental basis for international relations. You start with that, and then different theories build on that to develop tools for encouraging cooperation, for explaining why states make the decisions that they make. And what I found is that Lebanon kind of behaves in the same way. You know, if you think about it, what is the supreme sovereign authority above the political factions here? There really isn't. They are the sovereign in Lebanon, and they interact with each other the same way that independent states do. When you see a, you know, like Simon Frangier on Marcel's show last week saying, you know, if somebody comes into our areas or somebody does, you know, something to our supporter in their areas, we're going to target their supporters in our areas. I mean, this is the language of a party that thinks they're leading an independent state, because if you lived in a where there was a government that enforced laws on everybody, then this idea just wouldn't exist. Our areas, your areas, what we do, what you do, and the fact that you can't really, I mean, you can't hold a political leader accountable in Lebanon for this reason, because there is no authority above him or her to hold them accountable. So it's really a system of anarchy in Lebanon. And I think once we start thinking about it that way and understand the features of a system of anarchy, a lot of the things we see make complete sense. The decisions that are made and the way they make them, it you know, it explains a lot of it. It explains the failure of the Adib government, the French initiative, the way Hadid is trying to form his government now. And we'll talk about some of that. So there are, I picked four features that drive a system of anarchy, and to focus on those and to talk about those. The first one is the fact that the actors are rational. And what does that mean? And what does that tell us about Lebanon? What does balance of power mean? Especially the concept of the relative balance of power and the security dilemma. Threat credibility and the tragedy of the commons. So these are things that we're gonna go through. So there's a book that I recommend you if people are interested in this, read. It's called The Strategy of Conflict by Thomas Schelling. It was very enlightening for me. And a lot of things I read in it really shed light on what I've been seeing happening in Lebanon. Here's one interesting excerpt from it. Gang war and international war have a lot in common. Nations and outlaws both lack enforceable legal systems to help them govern their affairs. Both engage in the ultimate in violence. Both have an interest in avoiding violence, but the threat of violence is continually on call. It is interesting that racketeers as well as gangs of delinquents engage in limited war, disarmament and disengagement, surprise attack, retaliation. They worry about appeasement and the loss of face, and they make alliances and agreements with the same disability that nations are subjected to, the inability to appeal to higher authority in the interest of contract enforcement. So this idea that the relationship between states is also applicable to relationships between groups within states is not something that we're inventing. It's something that already exists, like the way gangs interact with one another. You could say maybe that's a very, that'll, you know, remind a lot of people about how, you know, characterization of Lebanese political factions. Anyway, so let's start with rational actors. What does it mean to be a rational actor? It means that each player...
You will be sharing off and on your screen, just some...
Yeah, I mean, would you guys rather me share the screen now? I mean, I could share it now, it's fine. I just didn't want people to just focus on reading and not listening. But I'll share it. And if people feel that they're being distracted, then I'll share it. All right. See what I do for you, Rasmi? I made a whole presentation.
I'm taking you out for drinks afterwards.
Yeah, minimum. Okay. So what is a rational actor? It just describes, and so we'll call them actor, player, whatever, but it's the same thing, Lebanese political parties or states or whatever. It's an actor that seeks to maximize value for itself, maximize its utility. That's what it means. And sometimes we see, you know, it described that, what are these little Lebanese politicians doing or these parties doing? They're not acting rationally. They're acting very crazy. But I think it really is, and especially they say that because we're seeing the system that they all depend on falling apart. So it's reasonable to think that these guys are acting very irrationally. But I think on the surface of it, it appears so. But once you dig into it a little bit more and you try to plot out all of the considerations that they have, then you could make the argument, and I think a convincing one, that actually they're acting very rationally, given the incentive structure that they're facing. So for example, Lebanese system, it's a multiplayer game. So you have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different factions. And each one is competing with the other to maximize its own power in this country. So when we talk about relative balance of power, states, one theory of international relations is that states seek to maximize not their absolute power, but their relative power versus the other players. So for example, if we're both gonna crash, but you're gonna crash more, then, you know, that's okay by me because relative to you, I'm gonna be stronger. So it's all right if I'm gonna lose power in absolute terms, I'm still gaining relative to you. And you're the threat and you're the competition that I have. So this is the game here in Lebanon. It is a multi-party game with each actor seeking to maximize power versus the other actor. And the reforms that are required in Lebanon are gonna, by definition, result in some type of shift in the current balance of power. Somebody's gonna win and somebody's gonna lose. And shifts in relative balance of power are, at least in the global scale, tend to be periods of heightened risk, higher chance for conflict. Whenever you have a powerful player losing power versus an up-and-coming power, this is an area of friction. And it often results in armed conflict on the IR level. So in Lebanon, I mean, what does that tell you? That each player is incentivized to avoid reforms that might harm its own balance of power position. It might be better for the country, but it's going to make me weaker relative to another actor. So I would rather do nothing. And whenever you have a consensual system, a consensual democracy like you have in Lebanon, where you need 6 to 8 or 10 players to all agree to do something for it to get done, all it takes is 3 to not want to do it, and you have stalemate. And that's what we have. So, you know, it ends up where Lebanese politics and policy is closer to something like an international treaty negotiation. And it has the same challenges where you have 10 parties, you know, like the Paris Climate Agreement. You have, you know, 180 countries, and they all have to agree to something, and there's going to be winners and losers. And so these become very long and difficult negotiations, and you can't run a country that way, right? You can do one-off international negotiations this way, but it's very difficult to run a country in that way. The negotiations become extremely difficult.
Your video is off, by the way.
Oh, you can't see the screen?
We cannot see you.
I don't think you can see my screen and me at the same time.
Oh, okay.
I think it's one or the other.
Too bad for those who joined to just see you, but anyway.
That's okay. They'll see me. I don't think anybody joined to just see me anyway.
they prefer seeing Mike. So just put your video on. We've tried both. It's like, so yeah.
Oh, I should take the screen down?
Yeah.
All right.
No, yes, and no, and yes, well, just do whatever you want, man. Anjab, academics, my God. Just show us your face. Show us your face. I'll upload the slides afterwards, so don't worry.
Tell you.
Okay. Yeah, this is much better.
Okay. Yeah, I'll share all these anyway.
I'll upload them and send them to you guys. So don't worry.
Okay. Another interesting excerpt from that book about rational behavior is that sometimes things that we perceive to be irrational are actually very rational if you consider the incentives and the impact of the actor that's carrying out this irrational behavior. So I'll read a small segment out. The apparent restrictiveness of an assumption of rational behavior, of a calculating value maximizing strategy of decision, is mitigated by two observations. One, which I can allege at second hand, is that even among the emotionally unbalanced, among the certified irrationals, there's often observed an intuitive appreciation of the principles of strategy. I'm told that inmates of mental hospitals often seem to cultivate deliberately or instinctively value systems that make them less susceptible to disciplinary threats and more capable of exercising coercion themselves. A careless or even self-destructive attitude of injury, I'll cut the vein in my arm if you don't let me, etc., can be a genuine strategic advantage. So can a cultivated inability to hear or to comprehend, or a reputation for frequent lapses of self-control that make punitive threats ineffectual as deterrents. So basically, by acting insane, that's not irrational. That's actually very rational, because it gets you to the outcome that you want, because the other party's threats don't work against you anymore. Okay, so the second feature of the system is the concept of relative balance of power and the security dilemma. So in the international system, players want to, everything is seen in existential terms. When states interact with one another, it is existential. It is about the survival and security of that state. And maybe we can see that the same way in Lebanese actors. Parties and factions represent sects or whatever, and they may see their existence here as a priority that they make decisions to secure that existence. So players want to secure their survival by preventing one player from gaining too much power to dominate all the others, taking advantage of weak players. And oftentimes the weaker players, when there's one player becoming very strong, will form a defensive coalition against that strong player. And in that context, players always want to maximize their power relative to others for the goal of ensuring their own survival and security. And that takes us to the concept of the security dilemma, which is a situation where in an environment of anarchy, when a player takes an action that's intended to heighten its own security, like increasing its military strength or making alliances or whatever, it can lead other players to respond with very similar initiatives, increasing their own military strength and making its own alliances, at least to maintain this balance of power, which ends up leading to an increased chance of conflict, even though none of them may desire conflict, but just in trying to ensure their own security, it ends up leading possibly to that outcome. And it's a dilemma that international institutions exist to try to resolve and make sure that that doesn't happen. So in the Lebanese context, you know, why don't they do reforms? The system is falling apart, everybody's losing. Well, you know, maybe they care more about their relative balance of power versus the others. So if we all fall, whatever, we all fell, we're still in the same situation relative to one another. If we have to do a reform, and I made a whole decision tree about that, and you find that actually, as an actor in this game, you have a higher chance of gaining if you do nothing. Because if you're the one who agrees to reform and offer concessions, but the others don't, then you're a big loser in this game. And when you see losses as existential, then you really can't make that decision. And with the security dilemma concept and the inability for players to make these concessions and actually the incentives to not make any concessions, you know, this creates an environment where actually players have an incentive to increase their relative power in other ways, like by arming themselves, for example, or finding other ways to do it. So it's a very dangerous time in Lebanon. And so, you know, maybe the Lebanese factions are acting totally rationally in this system that they're a part of, even though for the country as a whole, it is not rational. And then just as a subheading of this, there's this concept of bandwagoning, which we kind of see happening now. Bandwagoning is when a weak player wants to bandwagon or join with a strong player rather than form a defensive coalition against it. This happens when the weak player aligns itself with a stronger, but like an adversary of it, which is stronger than it, where it considers the logic being that I'm outgunned anyway, and the defensive coalition can't match this strong player. So let me just join it because maybe I can gain something, whereas I would lose if I was opposed to it in the defensive coalition. So when there's no possibility of building a defensive coalition against that strong player, the weaker ones will just bandwagon with it. So, you know, as we see the government formation process happening now, you could make the argument that some weak players who are forming the government are actually bandwagoning with the strong player who there's no defensive coalition that can form against it. So we'll talk about those examples later. So students of IR will recognize this excerpt that I'm going to read out now. And it tells you why bandwagoning happens and the role of weak players in an anarchic system. It's the story of the Peloponnesian Wars in Greece. It's called the Melian Dialogue. So the Athenians were sieging the Melians, and there's this dialogue back and forth between the two sides. The Athenians were much stronger. The Melians were very weak. And dialogue happening between both sides, which is very fundamental to the study of IR and the relationship between weak parties and strong parties in a system of anarchy. So I'll read it out to you and then I'll explain it. So the Athenians now are sending a response back to the Melians. The Melians were making the case that, why are you invading us? We didn't do anything to you. It's not right what you're doing. It's not fair. And so this is the Athenians' response. For ourselves, we shall not trouble you with specious pretenses, either of how we have a right to our empire because we overthrew the Mede, or are now attacking you because of wrong that you have done us, or make a long speech which would not be believed. And in return, we hope that you, instead of thinking to influence us by saying you did not join our adversaries, or that you have done us no wrong, you will aim at what is feasible, holding in view the real sentiment of us both. Since you know, as well as we do, that right, as in what's right, as the world goes, is only in question between equals in power, while the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. Basically saying that in a system of anarchy, there is no right and what's just. There is power. Who has the power to enforce their will? And who doesn't? And while now today there are institutions that try to mitigate that, because we don't live in an environment where basically the powerful just, no questions asked, do what they want, because there are institutions that they've developed because they consider it in their best interest to try to minimize that. But in reality, the strong powers still do what they want, and the weak ones have to work around that, regardless of what's right and what's just. And in a system of anarchy, even within a country, it's the same. The strong powers will get what they want, and the weak ones have to, you know, suffer what they must. Okay, so the third concept is the tragedy of the commons. And a lot of you may know that from economics. And it's a situation where you have a system of limited resources that is shared between different actors. And it is, again, also a system of anarchy, where each actor will try to do what's in its own interest, which is to get as much resources as it can. For example, if you have like a fisherman, each fisherman is going to try to fish as much as they can to get as many fish as they can. But that's has negative consequences for the system as a whole, because it'll deplete the resources. And that's the tragedy of the commons, where everybody does what's in their interest, but the outcome is not in the interest of everybody combined, because once the fish run out, all the fishermen are in trouble. And we see that in the Lebanese system of anarchy too, where individual political factions maximize their own self-interest because of existential concerns and a relative balance of power objectives. But those actions, while in their own personal interest, as a faction, I don't want to talk about individuals, as a sect maybe, as a whatever, but it is not in the common good of the country, and at the end, they all suffer for it. The only way to explain how the IMF program gets obstructed, how there's no progress on any reforms, how there's no reforms, period. And once the resources get low enough and there's still this conflict over those resources, it increases the risk of armed conflict in the country. Okay, so finally, there's this concept of threat credibility. Now, when you have a system of anarchy, you can't just sign a contract and then between two parties and then you have confidence that somebody's going to enforce it, right? It's a whole field of study of how do I let the other side know that I'm actually going to do what I say I'm going to do, when there's no law or rules that are going to enforce it on me. And this idea of threats and promises, this is how bargaining takes place in a system like this. you promise an incentive, you make a threat that you're going to do, you know, not a violent threat, but a threat as in, I'm going to do this if you do that or if you don't do that. And you need that threat that you're making to be credible, that you're going to actually carry it out so that the other party believes you and you can get it to do what you want it to do. And it's very difficult to actually make a credible threat because you need to first demonstrate that you have the ability to do it, that it's in your incentive to do it. Because if you just say, oh, if you don't do this, I'm going to blow everything up. Well, once the other party does that thing, do you then have an incentive to blow yourself up too? You don't. So that's not a credible threat. And so the credibility, which again, it goes to the heart of your bargaining power as a political faction in a system of anarchy. It depends on the costs and the risks of carrying out the threat and the other side's belief that you're going to do it. So what do and countries actually and factions care about losing face? Because if I make a threat and then I don't carry it out, that's going to hurt my bargaining position for the next time we bargain. Because then you're going to be like, yeah, these guys make threats, but they never carry them out. So losing face is actually a much bigger deal than just, oh, this person doesn't want to get embarrassed. It has implications for the next bargain that you try to make. And this is very important for Lebanon because you know, losing face, we talk about it a lot. So what are the strategies for actually making a credible threat here? You have to articulate it very clearly. It has to be well-defined. If you do X, I'm going to do Y. Not some general, this is a red line, which we hear this a lot here. And this is why we hear it. I mean, why do you hear people say in Lebanon, oh, you know, a party will say, this decision is a red line for us. It's because actually they're trying to make a credible threat. And they have very few tools available to them to make a credible threat other than saying this is a red line, meaning I have to carry out my threat if you do this thing. But they never tell you what the threat is and their ability to actually carry it out. So it doesn't seem that it's credible at all. Sometimes they'll do what's called a tripwire, where basically if I threaten something, I'll make it so that it's not a decision that I have to make to respond. Once you carry out the thing that I'm telling you not to do, the response is automatic. It's a tripwire. That makes my threat credible because I don't have to decide anymore after that. Like a fighting army, okay, that burns the bridge behind them so they can't retreat anymore. So it's not an option for them to retreat. Their threat is credible. They have to fight if you advance towards them. Or you'll make the threat fulfillment a matter of your honor, your country's honor, your sect's honor. It's why they, you know, you'll have the leaders of sects coming out and saying, this is a red line for us. Once you make it a matter of honor for the sect, how are you going to back down anymore? You can't. It may be a matter of backlash for you. Like, I have to fulfill this threat because the people that I represent will have a backlash against me. Anyway, so that's basically what threat credibility is and how it relates to Lebanon. But it's a very broad field, and I've only touched on a bit of it. You know, there's some other concepts that are very interesting, and you can read about them in that book. Like, what if you're making a threat to a madman, where that, you know, like the quote goes, madmen, like small children, can often not be controlled by threats. And here, you know, there maybe are many madmen involved in this game of politics in Lebanon. And if you threaten somebody without giving them a way out of, you know, the decision that you're trying to impose on them or the decision that they've said they have to make, then that party may react like a caged lion, you know, a trapped lion. So what we see, and, you know, part of the study of IR, they talk about how many wars have been started because parties made threats that actually they didn't really want to carry out, but they really tied themselves into having to carry them out. and maybe they riled up their population that I'm going to do this if you, you know, my adversary does that. You put yourself against the wall and you make it so that you can't go back on your threat anymore and start to spiral and maybe a war. And for example, I mean, we saw that in the government formation process in Lebanon, where in terms of the Ministry of Finance and who controls the Ministry of Finance, one side, Hezbollah and Amal, said that this belongs to our sect and it is a matter of, it's a red line, it's a matter of our existence here, the power in this country. The other side said the same. This, we have to share this position. And it is a red line for us. And the Batrak came out and the leaders of the other sects came out and it became a red line for everybody. So how do you, as a party, go back on that? I mean, it's either going to be shared or it's not going to be shared. So what is the solution when you've committed these like symbols of your national honor that you're not going to concede? It makes it so that negotiations become much difficult and it could lead to conflict. So let's talk about an example. So we've covered basically the main features of this kind of system, and it's helpful to put it into an example. Let's talk about the government formation process in Lebanon now and the Adib process and the French initiative. So we talked about the Ministry of Finance and how that became an intractable situation because, again, the players care about their relative balance of power. So Hezbollah Amal needed this position because they considered it to be part of their balance of power here. The other groups considered it to be a shift in the balance of power, so they needed to up the threats that, no, we would not agree with this because this shifts the balance of power. Everybody made it a red line. There was no solution to it anymore. So what happens now? Neither side can concede. So they need to find a way to concede without losing face because they recognize that if they just say, oh, well, fine, you know, it belongs to you or it belongs to us, this will make their future bargaining much harder. So they have to try to rationalize because one side is going to concede, okay? Because they have to, or you can't form a government in any other way. So what we're going to see is that the side that concedes is going to find a way to rationalize this concession. Me and a colleague of mine, Daniel Melhem, did a quantitative study of this game to find out what could a solution possibly look like. And what we found is for the Ministry of Finance, one scenario, we did this back in October, is that you could have, for example, Hezbollah Amal propose names and the other parties pick one. Then the other party can say, well, you know, we didn't really concede, we just found a solution. But in reality, that party conceded. But they need to save face. Now, in terms of the French initiative, okay, so there were, you know, we heard a lot about, yeah, or for one time only, or whatever, some nonsense like that. The point of it and the reason they're doing it is because they don't want to, sorry, I was just reading the comments popped up, is that they don't want to hurt their future bargaining position. Which is really crazy because they call everything a red line and it makes this idea of a red line, which the whole point of it is to make your threat credible. It makes it completely not credible because you've called a million things a red line and you just never did anything.
A spaghetti of red lines, as George said in the comments as well.
Yeah.
So we're just.
So what more can you do to make your threat credible if you've, it's a sign of weakness, to be honest, when you hear somebody call something a red line. It's often a sign of weakness because you have no other tools to make your threat credible. So you just call it a red line. There's very few players in Lebanon that actually can make credible threats. And those tend to not call things red lines. Let's look at the French sanctions threat. This was a threat that was intended to get the players here to make certain decisions, part of the bargain. Now, we talked about how threats need to be credible. Clearly, the French sanctions threats didn't work. Why didn't they work? Because for one, they were not credible at all. The threats that are real now are the sanctions that are real now are the US sanctions. These are the painful ones. These are the ones that are in process that have a possibility of happening. And they're well defined, that is. And the French don't control those. And actually, the US undermined the French sanctions threat by imposing their own sanctions while the government formation of Adib was taking place. The French didn't commit enough to the sanctions threat. They didn't say it publicly. It was kind of like under the table. A journalist had to break it, and Macron got upset that this journalist broke it. He left himself so many loopholes, Macron, to get out of having to impose sanctions. We talked about threat credibility through burning the bridge behind you. Macron built a highway behind him so that he doesn't have to impose the sanctions. There's an interesting excerpt from that book that I think I'll read now. It is essential for maximum credibility to leave as little room as possible for judgment or discretion in carrying out a threat. If one is committed to punish a certain type of behavior when it reaches certain limits, but the limits are not carefully and objectively defined, the party threatened will realize that when the time comes to decide whether the threat must be enforced or not, his interest and that of the threatening party will coincide in an attempt to avoid the mutually unpleasant consequences. So think of it in the French context. The French have an incentive for stability in Lebanon, right? They don't want a flood of refugees going to Europe. They don't want this country falling apart. So if they don't form a government, the country has become weaker. Are the French now incentivized to carry out their threat, impose sanctions, maybe lead to the country falling apart more? This is not in the French interest. You know, they don't care about prosperity in Lebanon. I mean, they're not opposed to it, I'm sure, but the French interest in Lebanon is stability, like all great powers' interest in small powers. They don't want the country to blow up. They don't want refugees. They have security issues in Lebanon. It's things like this. So the French would be harming themselves, actually, if they imposed these sanctions, which in any case were not credible. And then the French also proposed incentives, aid, IMF program, but these also were not well defined. What aid? How much aid? Aid for what? If we do what, we get aid. The US plays a bigger role in aid coming to Lebanon, especially an IMF program. So the definition of these incentives and threats was just not very well defined. And the French initiative just didn't consider these relative balance of power considerations. They thought, okay, do reforms. Well, we already know that it's difficult for them to do reforms because of the way the incentives are built, and the French never provided a way out of that. And so now what we might see is that in future bargains, players may seek to, how are they going to improve their bargaining power for the next time? You know, power here in an anarchic system is power on the ground. It's military power. So it's, you know, again, it's a very dangerous situation. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I don't know where a lot of time is going by. But, we did this study, me and Daniel, where we did a quantitative study of the government formation process game in Lebanon, where we took four players. This is at the time of the Adib government or the Adib attempted government. The other national parties, France and the US. We arranged four objectives: Ministry of Finance, regime stability, regional interests, economic reforms, and sanctions. And we did a mathematical analysis using, Daniel's a mathematician, and he used a nonlinear optimization method. It's basically a utility maximization for the economists out there. And we tried to look at strategies that these players might adopt against one another to try to figure out, well, what is the optimal solution here for these players? Not for the country, for these players. Try to figure out, what does a government formation look like? I'll just read the summary. Basically, and this study is going to be published, by the way. We got accepted into an economics journal. So stay tuned for Q1 2021.
Oh, wow. The academic is published now. F off now.
Hey, man. You want me not to publish it? I'll publish it on the website.
Sorry, the academic instead. Who publishes in Q1 journals.
No, this is my first publication, actually. But it's mostly Daniel's work. I was just a helper. He did all the math behind it.
Yeah.
But it's a very intuitive way to study politics, where you can use these mathematical models that we have. You have to make some assumptions, of course, but some very interesting things come out of these kinds of studies that in retrospect become intuitive. So I'll tell you. So both Hezbollah Amal and the other national parties had an interest in controlling the Ministry of Finance. We know this because it's part of the relative balance of power considerations in the country. But what we found was that Hezbollah actually weighed it a little bit more than the others. So finding the equilibrium solution for them is, it requires a cooperative approach. No party can impose itself on the other. It has to be one that satisfies both players. So one possibility, like I said before, is that Hezbollah Amal, they maintain this nominal control over the ministry, but the other parties share in some way in the nomination or selection process. Allows both sides to save face, but keeps control under the player that values it more in terms of their own utility. And why did we find that they value it more? Because what we found is that in the other strategy, the second strategy, that strategy was suboptimal, and it was one where the other national parties prioritized control over the Ministry of Finance much more. And in that strategy, Hezbollah Amal responded with their own strategy, which deprioritized the Ministry of Finance, but it also deprioritized the regime parameter. So what that means is their interest in the regime stability converged to zero, which means you have regime instability, which, you can interpret that however you want. So that was the only equilibrium we could find between these two factions, was one where Hezbollah Amal maintains control of the Ministry of Finance. And in the Harida government formation process, we're seeing this exact same thing play out. Harida is saving face by taking a list of candidates from that other party or parties, that faction, and selecting one. All parties had an interest in regime stability, not in the short term at least, not surprising. Interestingly, France had the highest interest in economic reforms. But that actually kind of makes sense, because the French interest in Lebanon is in stability, right? They don't want the country to fall apart. Maybe they have economic interests here, reconstruction or whatever. Whereas the other players maybe don't have as much of an economic, they don't value the economic reforms as much because they care about the relative balance of power here, which the French don't really care about. The French had the largest interest in the regional variable, which also makes sense because the French don't care just about Lebanon. They have regional interests that are much bigger than just Lebanon. And the failure of the French initiative actually hurts their regional interests, right? Because they lose face. If Macron puts all of the prestige of the French government behind this initiative and it fails, What does that mean for the French bargaining position and some future bargain in the country somewhere else? And people will be disappointed in this part, but in terms of sanctions, what we found is that the more you escalate sanctions, the more you have a less possibility of finding an equilibrium solution between the players. Actually, maybe that's also not surprising because that's kind of the point, right? Punish them, make the system, shake the system up so that we have a fundamental change from what we have now. But sanctions lead you to having no equilibrium solution. And it's a very fragile equilibrium as it is. Now, one final thing we found was that the US actually doesn't have an equilibrium solution with all the players. And it may be that the US's main interests don't reside in the variables that we pick, or vis-a-vis the other players. So maybe the game needs to be expanded. But we found an equilibrium between Hezbollah Amal, the other national players in France. But for the US, they didn't have an equilibrium solution with some others. Okay, so now I'm going to share my screen. We're almost at the end now of the presentation. So when we talk about no incentive to do reforms, I think conceptually I explained it, but what I'd like to do is just show a diagram that explains exactly why this, oh no, it doesn't look right. That sucks. Hold on.
Is that the one you posted on Twitter yesterday? If you want, send me the. I'll do.
Yeah, exactly.
I can either send me the document. I'll share it on my screen, or we could have done that earlier. But forward the document to me.
Bye.
Yeah, I think that would be the best way to do it. In the meantime, I'll share my screen. From yesterday's. Can you see?
Yeah, okay. That's, I think that works fine.
Send me the document as well. That would be probably just in case.
Okay. Should I send it to the decaf email?
Yep.
All right. Okay. If you try to plot it out, okay? Let's say you're player A, which is some faction in Lebanon. And you have to decide whether you do reforms or concessions. And your choice will depend on what the other players do because you don't want to be the only one doing that. So let's walk through one scenario, the optimal scenario for us, okay? That is in the common good, okay? Look at the very top lines. Player A does reforms, then player B decides also to do reforms and offer concessions, and then player C does the same. In terms of the relative balance of power, now listen, this is not a detailed quantitative analysis, but just conceptually, everybody did reforms, everybody offered concessions, you have no change in the relative balance of power. Everybody's still in the same position. They may be weaker in absolute terms, but
I'll share the screen. There you go.
The power just went out, so we probably lost half the people.
You think? No, we're good.
Okay. So in terms of the relative balance of power, you actually have no change. Everybody did reforms, everybody paid, and that's where you are. It's in the best interest of the country, but it, you know, from the perspective of the decision-making factions and players, you have no change. Now, what if just one player of the three, of the two, I guess, player B and player C, decides not to do reforms. Okay, so player A does reforms, player B does reforms, all good. And then player C decides not to. Now player A, and also player B, but we're looking at player A here, lost in terms of the relative balance of power, because you have one player that didn't do concessions, didn't do reforms, but the other two players did do reforms and concessions that hurt them. Now, if you plot out all of the possibilities for player A under a scenario where they do reforms, so the top half, they lose. Because if either player B or player C doesn't do reforms, player A loses. And if you look at these scenarios, the bottom half, where player A decides not to do reforms and not to offer concessions, in three of the four outcomes, they gain. Because they only need one player to do reforms for them to gain in the relative balance of power consideration. So where you end up is each player has a 70, you know, just generally speaking, has a 75% chance of having a positive outcome if they do no reform. Because in that bottom half of this diagram, it is, you know, that's what gives them a higher chance of having a gain. So if all three players face the same incentive structure, then where you end up is at the very bottom, the blue highlighted box, where nobody does reforms. Again, the country falls apart, but in terms of relative balance of power, you may have no change. But the country is worse off. And this is a fundamental feature of anarchic systems. In the global, in the international system, this is called a global collective action problem, where everybody has an incentive, each player has an incentive to cheat, right? Because when you cheat, you have a 75% chance of having a gain, because all you need is for the other players to not cheat. Now, there are tools or strategies for solving these global collective action problems. And obviously, they're successful because we have the Paris Climate Accord, which is a global collective action problem. You have a lot of things like this. But that's not a way to govern a country, right? That's good for like one-off global challenges that the whole world has to face, and you can afford 1, 2, 5 year negotiations to have a solution. But you can't for capital controls, you know, face this, and then for electricity reforms face this. You just end up not being able to make any decisions. Anyway, so, you know, the bottom line is that if we start seeing the way that this country functions and the way the incentive structures are built and the anarchic nature of the system, again, not chaos, but anarchy, you know, this is the structural flaws that people talk about, that it is the system, not the people, even though, you know, people are responsible, because even if incentives lead you to make certain decisions, you're responsible for the decisions you make, okay? But the system is designed in a way where if somebody new comes, if you drop people from space, the decisions may be exactly the same, because look at the chart in front of you. This is the incentive structure. So we keep spinning our wheels, I feel like, and even like the Thawra and all that, and on Twitter and what people demand, and that they try, we, myself included, try to force solutions that go exactly against the way the incentive structure is built, trying to think that I can impose a way of doing things or a way of making decisions that without incentivizing decision makers to have to do it. So what does that mean? I mean, we have to start thinking about how do we solve this? How do we solve this structural problem? And what does that mean? Because there's gonna be winners and losers, okay? You are in a system where people have factions, sects, whatever. In the same way in the international system, they have legitimate security. And you can't just ignore that. You need to find a way to incentivize all of the factions to take us to a system where you will have optimal outcomes. And you know, that's not my field, but when I see things happening here, you know, it is so rational, it is so predictable the way decisions are being made. And we haven't started really having the discussion around this, around the systemic problems that incentivize the poor decisions constantly being made. Anyway, that's it for the presentation. I hope you guys found it useful. Are there any...
Thank you very much, man. I was just trying to unmute myself there. Yes, I was keeping track of all the questions and we'll get to it. For those who wanted to check maybe the first few slides. Where's that? So this is from the first slide. I'll get to the questions from Thomas Schelling, the strategy of conflict, the quote. And we'll go over them. So first, let's see. I have several questions, and people are congratulating you on the publication, and asking when will it be out. If you have any idea.
Q1 at the Q1 of 2021. So maybe March.
March. Okay. So there's first. Abed is asking if you think Lebanese politicians have experts in game theory helping them in this and colluding with each other, or we just analyze the after fact of what they do. Like, are you, so is the game theory aspect, is it we trying to analyze, or are they aware of what they're doing, kind of speak, and they do it on purpose?
I mean, game theory is a way of analyzing behavior that we see happening. Because from the player's perspective, it is it's intuitive, right? Oftentimes it's intuitive. You see a system behaving in a certain way, you know, and you want to try to find out why are these decisions being made in the way they're being made. It doesn't mean they have a game theory person sitting down and trying to figure out, okay, what should we do now? It's intuitive. They know from their experience. And that's why it's important to put yourself in the shoes of somebody making a decision. As a Zaim, for example, as one of the 6 or 8 or 10, whatever, leaders here, they have a long experience. They interact with one another. They know bargaining because that's like their whole life. And so we're trying to explain why are these decisions intuitive for them? Of course, they probably have people who are thinking about, you know, how do we respond to this? You know, but when you see how they respond, often you think like maybe they should have some game theory people working for them, because you know, then maybe the Batrak or, you know, the leaders of other religious sects wouldn't come out and call things red lines, because you call it a red line, you can't do anything about it, and then your credibility is gone. So that was a bargaining mistake. So yeah, I mean, this is what political strategy is. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how to what extent political factions here really strategize versus just kind of do things based on experience and intuition.
You have met with a few of them. I don't know if you were able to see how things are internally, maybe if they know what they're doing or they're just.
I've never left a meeting thinking, wow, very strategic, very, you know, very well thought out and strategic decision making here. Actually, it's quite the opposite.
Interesting.
But you know, sometimes it's intuitive, you know, and it could be wrong. I mean, mistakes happen. That's why we have wars. You know, warfare is a failure of game theory. It's a failure of international relations, because the whole point is to avoid conflict.
I'll get to the questions in the chat first, and then I'll get videos. I think it's Lynn wants to ask a question, so I'll finish them first, and then I'll get to you. Where is that? George said or asked, how can we create a credible carrot and stick mechanism to be used on our political parties?
Well, let's think of it in terms of power, right? Because in a system of anarchy, power is what prevails. What is power in a system of anarchy? It's maybe military force, for example, arms. It's public pressure. If the whole street was united behind a vision. That's power. That's, you know, in international relations, you often think about it being a bargain over the use of violence. And that's seen in kind of the non-IR world as a pejorative, as a negative term. But it's really, it's not. It's the fact that violence is always on the table.
I muted all. I'll unmute you, Mike, shortly. Don't know who. Okay, unmute yourself, yep.
Okay. So in a system of anarchy, when you don't have this supreme sovereign that can enforce against the players, the power, the ability to have the outcome that you want in a bargain comes down to power, to violence. And not, again, I was saying not violence in the pejorative sense, as like I'm gonna go hit you, but really that's what it comes down to. It's the threat of violence, you know? And now of course the whole purpose of the bargain is to avoid violence. But if I'm sitting with somebody, if I'm a big country versus a little country and I'm bargaining, the fact that the big country can use overwhelming force against me if it doesn't get what it wants is a huge part of that bargain. So in Lebanon, what does it look like? For people, it means there needs to be street pressure behind, you know, that's rallies behind a particular vision. Unfortunately, that's not what we've seen here, because even the country is divided behind different visions. You have, you know, as much as we like to say that the political parties are way out of touch and don't represent, they still have a big following. So it needs to change, for one. It can come within the players themselves. It can come from one player increasing its bargaining power through arming itself, for example. It can come from the outside through an outside power using its overwhelming power and a bargain with the domestic players to get them to do something. So think of it in terms of power. Who has the power to force themselves, to force their side of the bargain? Because the powerful players do not give up power voluntarily, okay? As much as we think it's wrong, there's, you know, it's unjust, our side is just, the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. Unfortunately, this is the environment in a system of anarchy.
Oops. So Lynn B had a question. I don't know if you want to ask the question, Lynn, or you want me to read it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I can ask it. I actually wrote it in the chat. It's the same question, because I'm really interested in the concept of rationality applied to the case of Lebanese politics. Like in your presentation, you talked about the politicians' incentives, but I was interested in, I'm still like doing research about it. I don't know if I want to do it, but I was thinking like, we have the rational voter and the conventional political theory that votes following self-interest. But I was thinking that if that applies, then why do people, and not only in Lebanon, but all over the world, you see people voting against their self-interest if we define self-interest in economic terms. So I was wondering if we can actually argue that Lebanese voters, the people that are still voting for the sectarian leaders, can we argue the same way, saying that they are actually voting for their self-interest when they define their self-interest as protecting their existential right to, you know, like how they vote for a party because this is a Christian party that protects Christian rights, or this is a Shia party that protects Shia rights. But then we know that in terms of payoffs, they're not voting for their self-interest.
Yeah, it's an important question because the fact is people are voting in the way that you describe. In the US, for example, they say, you know, low-income people in Republican states vote Republican, even though Republican economic policies may hurt them. They calculate their payoff a different way. They see it in terms of culture, heritage, their existence, the existence of their culture. Race plays a role in it. In Lebanon, it could be the same thing. People are rational in the way they calculate their, personally, the way they calculate their payoff structure. To them, yes, their existence is, it is their, the existence plays a big part in how they vote. You know, you can't deny that minorities in Lebanon take a look at the region around them and see what happened to other minorities there. You know, that becomes number one, okay? Security, in the same way security comes number one in the relationship between states, in Lebanon, security comes number one because there is no supreme sovereign that can ensure security for everybody. Only my party does that. Even if it doesn't, even if it costs me my first. So that's why we don't do a policy here. That's why politicians don't get held accountable. We have 128 members of parliament, but you only ever hear about 8 of them. Because, you know, where are the other 120? What are they doing? They should, you know, they're not voted out because people vote existentially, period. And based on security concerns. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. How do you solve that? How do you give people this feeling of security where they don't have to think about that anymore? It becomes deprioritized. And they could start looking at, well, what's this person doing for healthcare? What's he doing for the economic crisis? What's he doing for whatever? That's the big question that we need to solve.
Thanks. Players and Jalul, players aren't afraid of player D being spawned, changing the equations, player D being all the people fed up from the system organizing themselves. So player, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought of it when I did that very simple diagram, because it extended to include, you know, more than three players, more considerations. It would be interesting to think about how that would factor into the payoff structure. I mean, look, maybe there was a concern about that in October, November, December, January. Remember, a government resigned because of it. Some decisions were made, okay? I mean, in January, February, March, there was this start of, okay, maybe we'll start doing reforms. I mean, I thought maybe some reforms would start getting made. But maybe it turns out that the probability assigned to a new player D entering this field is lower than we would hope or that we expected. And then it changed the calculations again. Maybe if the probability increases, it changes the payoff structure and decisions start getting made differently. But you have to, all of these, like a decision tree, you assign probabilities to decisions being made and where it takes you. And then you calculate an expected value. And then that's kind of the most likely outcome. So what is the probability of player D? Maybe at the moment it's small. And that's why it doesn't really factor into the expected value of, you know, of the ultimate outcome.
Let me see if there's some other comments. Someone is saying Sharbel Nahas program is based on game theory. He repeated it many times that everybody will go for second best choice. And Abed is saying game theory is based on the fact or the assumption that each player is rational. In Lebanon, history has shown us that rationality in the traditional sense doesn't really exist. Do you think using game theory to explain the conflict in Lebanon might be a stretch? Or maybe we are just in a, like well, you said, in a mental asylum, such that we are doing what is rational from within the system, perhaps?
I mean, the whole presentation was meant to make the case that actually these decisions being made are rational.
Yep.
If we understand what the payoff system actually looks like. So, you know, I don't know. This is really just kind of trying to understand because, you know, I can't buy they're just irrational, right? Because there's no system where the players are fundamentally irrational. Even the irrational ones make decisions in some way that is, if you analyze it further, is rational. Maybe to us it appears irrational, but to them and their payoff, it's rational. And again, you know, if we consider the payoff to be what is my relative balance of power in this country versus the other players, then maybe the decisions we're seeing are actually rational, even though they're not in the common interest. They're in the interest only of the very specific players.
Like Jack said, for example, like the red lines, the actual red lines, no one is able to get to, for example, are like key figures, like the governor of central bank, for example. This is what he said. I don't know if this also, like, this is the only place where they don't back down, right? Like they talk about red lines, but then when it comes to actual people there, no one can question their authority, as Cartman would say.
Because some players have red lines that they're able to enforce, and some players are weak and call everything a red line because that is the only way they have to try to come out as credible. So that's why you see some red lines not violated, right? Because there would be a backlash and a serious one because the threat is credible. And some, you know, it's just talk.
Do you think the Tufi is asking, do you think the judiciary has a role, if any, in changing the status quo? If so, do you think actually prosecuting someone would actually lead to civil unrest? Do you think the parties are bluffing?
You know, I hate to say this because it's not a good place to be. As like a person living in a country that's living through this kind of system. But I don't think the judiciary would make a difference. And the reason I don't think so is because the judiciary makes a difference if you have a super sovereign up top that can enforce the will of the judiciary. If you don't have that, then what teeth does the judiciary have, you know, to implement decisions, to arrest somebody, to imprison somebody independently? Sure, the judiciary can act when you have a majority maybe of the political factions or 9 out of 10 of the factions behind it, because they are the sovereign and they can allow it to act. But can the judiciary carry out, for example, you know, we have it, let's say, we pass all the laws for an independent judiciary. The judiciary decides to arrest somebody from the 8 factions we have here. How is it going to do it? If they don't want to, if the factions are against it, how is the judiciary going to do it? So there is, you know, this idea that laws, passing laws, or having a independent judiciary in the sense that we understand it will solve this problem, I think that's not the case. Because so long as you have anarchy in the system, there's no way, unless the judiciary has the biggest military in the country that it controls on its own, then its decisions won't be respected.
Which brings up the million-dollar question, no? How can we resolve the entire situation? Which is, it's just a rhetorical kind of question. Naji is asking, while I understand that the common interest doesn't coincide with the individual interests, I am not sure the politicians had a perfect foreknowledge of what would happen at the time they put the country in the current economic situation. In other words, do you think that politicians were acting, or we go back to the rationally, and they had an accurate assessment of the situation when they torpedoed the CEDAR conference just to avoid reforms? Do you think they would do exactly the same thing if they could go back in time? He thinks it's not obvious. And your approach, this is a comment. If you want to tackle that first. Like, do you think they would, if they go back in time?
Yeah, I mean, if they can go back.
In time to the CEDAR conference, would they do things differently?
It's hard to say, because maybe they would do things differently knowing the outcome, but maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they wouldn't because, again, you need 8 factions to decide to do reforms. The reforms are going to cost some more than others. And so there's going to be a blocking faction, the one that actually loses from the reforms. And maybe they see the situation now as, well, the reforms would have cost us more than what the, because the cost that we're paying now is a cost that the country is paying. It's not a cost that that faction may be paying, right? But that faction decides. So maybe they, you know, maybe their payoff would be exactly the same if we go back in time. Think of it as, what is player A's incentive? Not what is the country's incentive, not what is the country paying. What is player A, what is his incentives or hers, and what are they paying based on the outcome of whatever decisions that they make?
Do you think the second part of the question is asking if you think foreign powers affect the outcome also? Or your approach doesn't take into account foreign influence on local parties, no? Like, what would you...
It's the same framework. It's taken into account based on what threats and incentives they offer the local parties. That becomes part of the decision tree for them. For example, if you come and give player A $1 billion to take X decision, and they find that, well, with this $1 billion, even though X decision costs us, but we're getting $1 billion that makes up for that cost, then maybe they'll do that. But you don't even really need to go that far. You know, if the schematic didn't explain the decisions they made, then we would start thinking, well, it's just, we're not able to explain what we're seeing, so there's got to be something else. But, you know, we don't really need to go that far. Incentive structure in this country by itself explains. Now, of course, there's foreign players and foreign influences. I mean, the French initiative is a foreign influence, the US sanctions, Iran, Saudi, Turkey, whatever, they all play a role. But the role they play, I think it plays a role insofar as, in the current environment, insofar as it affects the players' relative balance of power in the country. Like, I don't think some outside force can come and offer a Lebanese player an incentive, money, whatever, to dismantle itself and disappear, because that goes contrary to its fundamental security considerations for this country, right? So the foreign players can play a role in how the payoff is constructed, but there's some things that they can't do. You know, like, you're not going to come and tell FPM, here's $1 billion, disappear, because, you know, it's just the insane, like, if the $1 billion versus existential, this is existence in the country, it's like saying, I'll pay you a lot of money if you go kill yourself. Okay, well, the payoff, even with all this money, to me, is negative. You know, there's no amount of money you can offer me for that to become a positive payoff for me. That's in the extreme.
The question, it's a I'm going to try to ask you this in light of what you just said and in light of Albert's upcoming episode. And a few more questions and we'll start wrapping it up. But would you say that based on what you discussed from analyzing it this way and saying that these are the eight players, X amount of players, we have probably two possible solutions. On the one hand, you either try to transcend the system, so you try to get them to get together and you establish a judiciary which is actually independent and they all agree to that, or you accept the status quo and decentralize. Like, would decentralization, accepting the fact that there are eight players, you know, these are the players, so instead of centralizing it and like let them disagree on things that are geopolitical and let them at least do like provide services for the people, you know, in a decent kind of way. I don't know. So it's in a way, this is how I view it. I don't know if you agree with it's.
I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. As I see it, whatever solution has to address the number one thing, which is each community's security and existential concerns. So anyone who is proposing some change to the system, like federalism, various forms of decentralization or federalism or confederalism, yeah, it has to address that. If you tell me I'm only offering services on the local level, does that solve it? Based on this type of analysis, I don't think it does, because that doesn't really address the security concerns. Security, I mean your existence concerns. Okay, you have power, but I'm still afraid of the other faction. Okay, I don't have a sovereign that can protect me, or that can hold the, you know, whatever other faction accountable, because there's nothing above them. It's still them. It's still anarchy. It's still a system of anarchy. So what I would propose to people, because these are the questions we need to be asking, and I propose to people who are putting out these very interesting ideas, and I think people are a lot more open to them now. Like federalism, for example, was a taboo 2 years ago. Now it's not a taboo. You know, without taking a position on whether federalism and what kind is the right thing, or partition, or centralized government, or different types of decentralization is right, you need to show how what you're proposing addresses these issues that I've described here. Decentralization, I've not heard a case made yet that tells me decentralization solves the security concerns of different communities. I haven't.
Interesting.
But yes, these are the type of solutions. Unfortunately, we talk about system-wide solutions. This is basically what it is. It's not just a matter of passing a law that says we have an independent judiciary. It's not enough, because it doesn't solve the anarchy problem.
And we have to address that. Another power in the eye of the beholder. Collectively, the political parties don't represent more than 40% of the Lebanese. What about the remaining 60%? Who represents them? How can we bring their voice to the game theory?
For them to be a force, a defensive coalition, okay? We talked about when you have one faction becoming too strong, you have what comes out of that is a defensive coalition. So the 60%, if it's 60, in order to be an effective defensive coalition, you would need them to be united behind a shared vision, a shared goal. If you have 40% on one side, and on the other side you have 5%, and then 10%, and then 5%. And no, the 40% is still the strongest player in this multipolar game. So one of the biggest complaints that I have is that you don't have a united opposition here with a vision that solves the problems that we've been discussing for 2 hours. And that in and of itself is a feature of the system. So, you know, if you belong to a Thawra group or some kind of non-mainstream party,
how can the other question is, how can they leverage it, the Thawra party, since you just mentioned that Lynn asked the question?
The only way you're going to get the existing power structure to cede power is by becoming more powerful than it, period. It's not by appealing to their goodwill or what's right or what's just. You need to have more power than the existing mainstream power. And the only way you can do that, short of becoming an armed resistance, which nobody wants, is by having a united opposition, united behind a shared vision that can go down on the street, that can change the outcome of elections, things like this. That is the only way to do it.
I think people who like Foucault, I don't know if you know who Foucault is or read Foucault, they would be rejoicing by your comments, but I'll read two more, but we'll have to talk about this over drinks. I'll explain my viewpoint on all this. Zahi is asking, so two more, yeah. What would be more possible, finding a solution to the existential threat, finding a way out from the anarchy system, or waiting for the change, for time to change the players? Like, we've already addressed this, but it's an interesting point. Like, what do we do? Like, why are you here, for example, and trying to, right? So
we can't wait until the players to change, because there's 6 million people who are suffering, you know, so it's too costly. And we have no guarantees that when the players change, the systemic features of the Lebanese political system won't continue to exist as they are, and the new players will be exactly the same. So we need something else. And the first two, I think, are the same. We need to find a system that addresses the existential issue that communities have, the security dilemma, and create a opposition that can rally behind that vision, I think. Why am I here? I don't know. It's an uphill battle. I mean, why are we all here, you know?
Many of us are just trying to leave. You're not, which is weird.
Well, I may not be far behind you. You never know.
Hell yeah. I'll ask them together, because they might be related. You might have discussed that already. Community, how about Sherbil is asking, are you the Sherbil I wanted? We spoke on Twitter. Yes, I should have muted you. I'm not going to take your question because I already told you that, but not that. Anyway, how about communities engaging each other? Would that reduce the security concerns, engage in grassroots dialogue? Do you work in an NGO, Sherbil? That sounds like an NGO thing. And Lynn is asking, how can your analytical framework be used to devise exit strategy for key players in the political system to offer a way out, like a kind of a way to deviate from their current national strategy? So on the one hand, the way out, on the other hand, if we get communities to engage in a grassroots dialogue, would that solve the problem? And maybe the also Bassem university elections and stuff like that, for example?
Well, cultural exchanges are very important. And we should have actually been doing that after the Civil War. I mean, you know, it's sad to talk about cultural exchanges in Lebanon. We're all Lebanese. But the fact is, it's a thing, you know? Like in Tripoli, most of my friends have never been to the south. They've never been to the mountains. So when they go up there, they're doing a cultural exchange. It's all new to them. They're seeing new things. So foreigners, okay, or Lebanese expats have maybe been to more places than Lebanese people living here, because that's, you know, it's just how it's built. It's important, but, you know, this takes generations. You know, it takes generations for people to change their primary identity from X sect to, or X tribe or X ethnicity or whatever, to something else. It's part of the nation building process. You need to have a national narrative of where we all come from and where we all want to go. You know, the US is a very diverse place, but they have that. Lebanon doesn't have that. It's important to work on, because even whatever system we go with, we are all neighbors and we all live in the same place, and we need to have this. I mean, listen, we share the same culture. So we're not going to get away. Lebanon's not going to become five islands, you know, one in the Pacific and one in the Atlantic. How do you change their the political factions calculus? You know, I really don't know. I wish I did. I mean, the only thing I could think of, I don't think you can change it. I don't think you can change the calculus. I think you can create this player D that somebody mentioned, a third, a fourth, a fifth player that can change the calculations that way, can introduce new considerations in it. And at the end, you know, even if you decide you come up with an optimal governing structure for Lebanon, okay, that's not going to be in the interest of the existing power structure because, again, by definition, it requires a shift in the balance of power. And they're not going to do it because power doesn't give itself up voluntarily. So you need this player D to change the calculus. And fundamentally, I think that's what we're all here. Those of us who have stayed here are staying because there is this hope that maybe this player D can sprout up into existence. And many of us feel like they have some value to add to this player D that maybe today we don't see it, but things can change very quickly. Maybe there'll be a player D in 6 months. And you want to be here to, you know, to at least try to contribute to how this player D formulates its own decision tree, if you want.
Conspiracy theories. And okay, the last one. Thank you for doing this. But Eli is in a no-win scenario. Will the status quo result in something beneficial? Silver lining in the end.
Will what lead to?
In a no-win scenario, will the status quo result in something beneficial in the end?
Not for the public. I mean, you know, it's the tragedy of the commons, you know, where it's the status quo is in the worst interest of the, you know, the common good. To the extent it creates this, you know, I like this concept of the player D, so I'm saying it a lot. This player D to spawn and change things, then maybe it's beneficial, you know? But as is, now we just, nothing changes except we go down this path of least resistance, most likely outcome based on the incentive payoff of the existing power structure. No, it's in the worst interest, it's, you know.
Everyone is talking about the D now, Jack is saying, but, so you see, my last comment would be, or I don't know if you agree with this, because I keep on seeing the dynamics, the same dynamics exhibited by upcoming or emerging groups, right? There's always this narrative of if you think differently, then you're against us. So even newly emerging groups and parties, if you just disagree on something very simple, they come at you like it's a witch hunt kind of thing. So this is also problematic. Like, how are we going to have a dialogue if we at a level where, like, what if I don't like what you're offering, but I would want to talk with you, no? So it's that's also problematic.
Exactly. I mean, this is why we haven't seen a unified front in the opposition, because أنت حمار منك معي. And so you have this view about the optimal healthcare system. And so we're in a position right now to talk about healthcare policy and rent controls on houses. Or this guy has some baggage, okay? So I don't want to deal with him. I think we're in a situation where we need to focus on, as Don from Twitter says, the root cause. What is the root cause of the problem? Okay, forget policy for a second, because you're never going to get to implement your policy so long as things are as they are. What is the root cause? Who can you ally with to implement that solution that you have proposed? And it may require you to ally with people that you wouldn't otherwise ally with, okay? Maybe you're, you know, you have a right wing or, you know, a right economic policy view. You might have to ally with the leftists, okay? Because that's in your common interest right now. You can fight the other battles later on. You may have to ally with somebody who you say, you know, is maybe an MP here in Lebanon, who you say, oh, I don't like this MP. But you know what? You're making common cause on something. So fine. You need all the help you can get now to solve the root cause. If you can make common cause on solving the root problem, then I think you should. Because otherwise, the opposition is going to constantly be fragmented. And that 40% is always going to be the majority.
True. So yeah, this is also, and it goes both ways, right? Because on both sides, they start not only like metaphorically blocking each other. You just mentioned Dawn, and then I think now many people who recognize the name, who's going to be on the Albert's episode, they're going to be cringing. Like, well, let's have a dialogue. It's okay. Like, we're, you know, I don't see where the problem is, to be honest. So, but anyway.
Things get personalized. Things here get personalized.
Yes.
They try to put you in a box that, oh, he is X. Okay. Because that's how we think of things here. That's how we understand the other. He has to be, he's this party. Even if he's not, doesn't belong to any party. Because we need to label each other. But in fact, sometimes there is no label. Sometimes there's different visions for the country. And that's fine. You can be friends with the person. You might have completely opposite visions, but it doesn't mean the other person is an idiot. You might think his political views are idiotic.
Which is fine.
Yeah, that's fine. But like, you can be friends with this person, you know, this is one thing, and that's the other thing is completely separate.
Yep. And this would be a great place to start. Understanding that political differences, we can have discussions about them, then we can, and we keep friendship aside, like, yeah. Anyway, so thank you very much, Mike, for doing this. This has been very interesting. And I mean, let's hope we can have more discussions like that and dialogues to discuss things in a chill, laid back setting, kind of. Thank you all for joining.
Thanks, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed the session. It should be up on YouTube also shortly. So thanks again. Ciao.
Thanks, Leslie. See you.
Cheers.
Thanks, everyone.